Welcome to another RSO podcast. I'm Margot Stedman, Education and Community Engagement Director, and I'm here with our music director, Stephen Larson, to learn more about the upcoming concert on April 7th and get answers to burning questions like, why Joplin?
I've been waiting for this moment to happen for some time now, when somebody would ask me about this next program that we're going to be doing. And it finally happened at rehearsal for our last concert. A couple of people from the orchestra came up and said, okay, Dvorak, Brahms, Stravinsky, why Joplin? How did that get in there? Well, Joplin has some connection with this in a sort of a strange way. Let's start with the Dvorak, though. Antonin Dvorak wrote his Prague waltzes in 1878, and he wrote them in a very short period of time. Possibly even a couple of days. And he intended them just as some light entertainment for a holiday concert that was taking place in December that year. And after that, he pretty much forgot about them. They never popped up again. Scott Joplin also wrote his pieces, the ragtime works, mostly as entertainment, although he was a little more serious about it than a lot of his contemporaries. Both of them, both Dvorak and Joplin, used the popular genres of their time. The waltz was a wildly crazy and wildly popular dance in the 19th century, and people wrote all sorts of waltzes. And Joplin was one of the pioneers, the greatest composer probably, of the ragtime era, the late 19th, early 20th century. The ragtime style developed from slave music, influences can be traced all the way back to Africa, but certainly back to the slave plantations. And then after the Civil War, after the slaves were emancipated, there was some interplay with military bands. Military bands were very popular in the United States in the 19th century, late 19th century. And a lot of freed slaves played in these military bands and got sort of caught up with the marches that were popular that day, and combined them with this influences, this ragtime, and that's how it really got started. There's other genres like the cakewalk from this era that many other composers, European composers, caught up and used in their work. Erik Satie, Claude Debussy, and even Stravinsky got involved with some ragtime music and cakewalk and things like that in his later works. Eventually, this all morphed into early jazz, and it disappeared. The ragtime disappeared by about World War II. So I think there's a connection between the opening work of the first half of the program, the Prague waltzes, and the opening work of the second half, the two rags by Scott Joplin. Certainly in style, they're very, very different. We tend to think of Dvorak as being a serious composer, but serious composers back then also did a lot of dabbling in very light, very popular music. We just don't hear that much of it in the concert hall because we want much more important things, don't we? Now, we're going to follow this with a violin concerto. And name all of the great violin concertos you can think of. And if you can't think of any, I'll throw some off just that come to my mind. There's Mozart. Mozart, he wrote five. The third is the most popular. Beethoven's violin concerto. Mendelssohn's E minor violin concerto. Max Bruch's three violin concertos. Tchaikovsky's violin concerto. Saint-Saëns wrote some violin works, violin concertos and other works for solo violin. Jean Sibelius wrote a violin concerto. Alban Berg wrote a violin concerto. Shostakovich wrote a violin concerto. Sergei Prokofiev wrote two of them. Béla Bartók wrote a violin concerto. Samuel Barber wrote a violin concerto. I missed a couple of people. Let's throw them in here just for contrast. Niccolo Paganini wrote five of them. How many have you heard? And of course, Edouard Lalo wrote some very popular works for violin. Now, let's go down this list of composers and see what they played. Mozart was a pianist. He was an amateur violist, but really wasn't all that good. Beethoven was a pianist. Mendelssohn was a pianist. Bruch was a pianist. Brahms was a pianist, although he studied cello as a kid. Tchaikovsky was a pianist. Saint-Saëns was a pianist. Sibelius. Now, he was a violinist, but he wasn't all that good. Alban Berg was a pianist. Shostakovich was a pianist. Prokofiev was a pianist, although for some time his girlfriend was a concert violinist, and that had something to do with the construction of these pieces. Bartok was a pianist. Barber was a pianist. Paganini, a virtuoso violinist. And Lalo, a competent violinist. So why are all these concertos written by pianists, at least the best ones? Paganini, if you've heard maybe one of Paganini's concertos, you're probably doing pretty well. There's only two of them that ever get performed. So why are all the great violin concertos written by pianists? And why are there not more violinist composers? Well, I don't think anybody really knows. I have a couple of theories. One is that pianists tend to have a greater command of the entire spectrum of music, the whole vertical structure, the chords. They're able to accompany violinists. They're able to play scores at the piano. The piano is sort of a substitute for the whole orchestra. So they see the entire picture. Violinists, even if they are competent pianists, and many of them were, I think tend to have less free time than pianists did. If you were a violinist, particularly a very good violinist, you were in demand as a concert soloist. You probably also played, if you were even somewhat lower, below that level, you probably played in an orchestra, and that was basically a full-time job. You may have also taught in a music conservatory. And in short, violinists tended to be much busier, at least much more constricted in their schedules than pianists were. Pianists could take a little more time to compose than the typical violinist could. If the violinist did want to write a violin concerto, they tended to write flashy showpiece violin concertos for themselves to show off how great they were. And these tend not to stand the test of time. The pianists, however, tend to take a more musical approach to constructing these pieces, and usually will bring in a consultant, somebody to help them write the violin concerto. Brahms, for instance, who we're featuring on this program, Brahms's violin concerto. Brahms, his very close friend was Joseph Joachim, and Brahms worked very carefully, very long and intensely with Joachim to make sure that the violin part was playable, difficult enough, and ultimately fit in with his own musical aspirations for the work. Now, in contrast to that, Tchaikovsky, who was writing his violin concerto right about the same time Brahms was, didn't consult anybody. They certainly didn't consult the person that he was writing the piece for, Leopold Auer. And when Leopold Auer got a copy of the piece, he was kind of appalled by what he saw and finally said, I just don't think that this is playable. That led to hurt feelings, and he ended up not doing the premiere of the piece 3 years later. That went to Adolf Brodsky. Brahms, on the other hand, did things very methodically, very carefully, the way he always did. And in this case, it turned out well, because almost from the very beginning, this concerto was a hit. Brahms, as always, was composing, looking over his shoulder, looking for the shadow of Beethoven. He waited till he was 40 to write his first symphony because he knew he had to write a work that was at least as good as, if not better than, Beethoven's symphonies. And I think he succeeded there. And the same thing was true of a violin concerto. Beethoven's violin concerto was considered to be the standard, the best, the greatest concerto written up to that moment. And Brahms, indeed, I think, equaled, if not bettered, Beethoven at this. It's a conventional piece in some respects. It's in three movements, although he started out by, he was going to write four movements, like he wrote for the second piano concerto, but eventually scrapped those two and used a conventional three-movement form, a fast movement, a slow movement, and then a fast movement, and usually lighter than the first movement, lighter and shorter. And that's what this one was. It hasn't always been popular with everybody who played it. One violinist was quoted by saying, "I will not play in a piece where I have to sit in the stage and listen to the solo oboe play the most beautiful tune in the whole piece. Well, I don't get to play anything like that at all." But most violinists have taken the challenge and made this work a part of their repertory. Igor Stravinsky, in a way, is a lot different than the other people on this program, the other compositions. Stravinsky was a romantic composer only for a very, very short period of time, and never really a romantic composer. That's probably why his teacher at the conservatory, Glazunov, thought he really wasn't very talented, because he just didn't fit into the mold of the romantic 19th century composer. But the Firebird, that great ballet from 1910, was the work that really made him famous, that launched his career on the international stage, and really only the fifth piece that he had published in his entire lifetime. By this point, I think he was 25 when the the Firebird was premiered. Before this, orchestrally, he had written, well, we thought he had written really one piece before this. Well, two pieces. There was a scherzo, but that doesn't get done very much. Fireworks, work from 1908, gets some play in orchestras. But a recent discovery turned up a piece called Funeral Song, which he wrote on the death of his teacher, Nikolai Rimsky-Korsakov, in 1908. And that's interesting because you hear some Rimsky-Korsakov in that piece, but you also hear a lot of something you never hear again in Stravinsky, and that's Wagner. A lot of similarities between this piece and Siegfried's funeral music, for instance, from Gerhard Dameron. But we're not here to talk about this particular work. We're here to talk about Firebird. But let's back up a little bit and talk about Fireworks, the piece he wrote immediately before this in 1908. Here you hear a lot of Rimsky-Korsakov, a lot of the orchestration techniques that he taught Stravinsky, a lot of the same harmonies. You hear these progressions which analysts have described as uncanny harmonies, these very strange and very enticing chord progressions that just seem to be so peculiar and yet so beautiful, that you hear so much in the Fireworks and especially in the Firebird. This Firebird, of course, was the first of the three great ballets that made him really launched his career as the greatest composer, certainly the most influential composer of the 20th century. 1910 was the Firebird, 1911 was Petrushka, and 1913 was the Rite of Spring. And each one of these three works, you hear this incredible progress, this incredible movement in this composer from one style to another. Well, not so much one style to another, but one facet of the style to another. In Firebird, you still hear a lot of Rimsky-Korsakov. You hear the uncanny harmony progressions. You hear the brilliant orchestration. And you think you're hearing romantic music and a lot of some very romantic sounds. When in fact, you're really not. If you really listen to this piece carefully, you hear a lot, and especially if you study it carefully, you hear a lot of what Stravinsky would really exploit later in his life. The sort of cut-and-paste method of taking a block of sound and adding another block of sound to it, and then adding another block of sound, and maybe changing it completely after that, and putting together these blocks of sound in such a way that they create a whole. And I've been sort of amused to see, in doing some internet research, to see that the Firebird pops up on compilations like the most relaxing music and the most beautiful music in the world. And things like that, the easy listening things. And this kind of shocked me, because if you listen to the Firebird Suite, the 1919 Suite, which we're playing in this concert, there are moments that will make your hair stand up. As a matter of fact, there is the beginning of the Infernal Dance of King Kaschai. There is an enormous crash that opens that will, if you've have been so misfortunate as to fall asleep in the very soothing music before this, you'll be very rudely and very abruptly awakened. The first section has some very creepy music in it, some very strange sounding things. But by the time you get to the end of the piece, with the movement of the berceuse, the lullaby, and finally the finale, things get into a very, very beautiful groove in which you sit and you just let this beautiful sound wash over you. And here you can hear in particular something that became a characteristic of Stravinsky's all of his life, The use of little bits or shapes of folk music. Russian folk music is very distinctive in that it tends to follow a very small, very narrow range, and tends to repeat a lot of the same motives again and again, something that Stravinsky used all of his life. It's still the most popular and most frequently performed work by Stravinsky 116 years later, 117 years later, and it's very frequently found on concert programs. It's liked by both audiences and orchestra members equally well. It's a great challenge to play, a lot of fun to play, and a lot of fun to listen to. Very colorful orchestrations, beautiful, beautiful music, and some really breathtaking moments. I wonder if Stravinsky would have been prepared for this at the time he wrote it, knowing that this piece would become essentially a war horse. The man who went through his life changing styles over and over again to not repeat what he was doing, to find that one of his early pieces was now a mainstay of the concert repertory. I don't think he would have liked it very much, but he was very, very happy as an astute businessman to accept all of the royalties that rolled into his bank account for the many performances.
And with that, we hope to see you at the concert on April 7th.